Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Welcome to another edition of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston, and believe it or not, we've only got a couple of weeks of 2023 remaining, which means I only have two more episodes left this year. I'm going to take the last 2 weeks off because I'm going to be traveling to see some family and busy doing other important things like eating, drinking, watching football, sleeping, and, well, sleeping some more. But don't worry, I'll be refreshed and ready to go with my first podcast of 2024, slated to be released on January 4th. But before I move on to 2024, I'd like to review some of the big legislative victories that Democrats were able to bring home during the first year in complete legislative power in 40 years. And joining me to discuss some of those victories, some shortcomings, and what kind of power do progressives have inside the Democratic Party, or do they already wield some real power, will be Democratic State Representative Emily Diefendorf from the 77th House District, which comprises of North Lansing and DeWitt. Representative Diefendorf is the fighter for true progressive values, or better known, as I always say, as common sense values. Now, they've spent their lives being a strong advocate for a number of progressive values and helped pass some bold legislation in terms of voting rights, LGBTQ plus rights, abortion rights, long-needed investments in our education system and our environment, and also long-needed investments in our people. So Representative Emily Diefendorf will join me here in just a few minutes. And I know one question I will ask her is, I will want her take on a decision by the Michigan Public Service Commission, which could have dire consequences here for the state for years to come. Yes, I'm talking about the MPSC's decision to greenlight a tunnel for Enbridge Energy's Line 5 pipeline. Now, this decision sent shockwaves across the state as the commission, by a 2-0 vote, granted the Canadian oil company the right to build a tunnel around the portion of the 645-mile petroleum pipeline, which lies at the bottom of the Straits of Mackinac. Now, rather than doing the right thing by closing the 70-year-old rickety pipeline that runs light crude oil from Superior, Wisconsin to Sarnia, Ontario, these regulators went against public opinion, science, and common sense and instead swallowed whatever the energy company told them. Now, as I've said before, our Great Lakes are an economic engine to our state, helping support some 1.3 million jobs and $80+ million in wages in our state. It provides one-fifth of the world's freshwater supply, one-fifth. The Great Lakes are so valued and treasured that millions of people living out in the Southwest are hoping that we'd supply that water to them because, you see, they live in a desert. They don't have enough water because it's a desert. The Great Lakes are important. They are an important piece to Michigan's environmental and economic benefits, which is why many citizens are calling for the closure of the Line 5 oil and natural gas pipeline in the Straits of Mackinac. This old pipeline has already spilled around 1 million gallons of oil in the last half century. We almost experienced horrific disaster back in 2018 when a tugboat anchor damaged a stretch of the pipeline in the Straits. It was just another of a long list of signs that closing down Line 5 was imperative to ensure it didn't imperil Michigan. But if you remember, then-Governor Rick Snyder and his Republican majority passed a bill allowing Enbridge to rebuild a new portion of the pipeline and to also encase it with a new tunnel, costing millions and millions of dollars while taking a decade to construct. Governor Gretchen Whitmer and Attorney General Dana Nessel have tried to close down the pipeline, but those efforts did not stop Enbridge from continuing to transport oil and gas at the bottom of the Straits. And despite there being so many other options to transport that oil, or to just decide that relying on a mid-20th century pipeline for a mid-21st century energy plan is plain insanity, the MPSC had no problems adopting and trusting, mind you, Enbridge's plans over scientific common sense and over the people of the state of Michigan. MLive's Sherry McWhirter described the decision this way, and I quote, "The regulatory agency found there is both a public need for the energy product Line 5 carries and a need to replace the underwater section to protect the Great Lakes waters. Commissioner said the company's plan is the most prudent option. Enbridge says it's ready to get to work. Now only environmental review by federal authorities remains pending." Okay, now I'm not criticizing McWhirter's reporting at all because she's correctly highlighting why these commissioners voted to okay the tunnel project, because these commissioners went for the economically prudent option rather than doing the right thing for the long term. Writer Jeffrey Insko had the following insights in this disastrous decision, and I'd like to thank our friends from Oil and Water Don't Mix for linking to Insko's piece on this. And he writes about oil and the environment for a living. In his post titled MPSC Line 5 Postmortem Part 2, Insko nails exactly why these commissioners went along with Enbridge. Now, after describing how the commission limited the scope of questions in this hearing, which hurt anti-Line 5 advocates and helped Enbridge, Insko wrote the following, and I'm quoting here, so follow along. "But what's even more astonishing is just how little consideration staff's process-oriented thinking gives to whether and how a narrow review might advantage one side and disadvantage the other. And there was never any question as to which side would benefit by this narrower scope. As I mentioned in my last post, Enbridge argued for exclusions at every turn. Here's just a brief list of things that Enbridge sought to have excluded from consideration. The need for Line 5, construction of the tunnel, the current operational safety of Line 5, climate change, the environmental effects of the extraction, refinement, or consumption of the oil transported by Line 5, tribal treaty rights, examination of terrestrial archaeological sites in the Straits, and the 2010 Line 6B spill. Enbridge got its way with almost all of this. In fact, even in those instances where some allowances were made for consideration of greenhouse gas emissions, for example, those allowances came with absurd restrictions, only greenhouse gas emissions related specifically to the activity of rerouting Line 5 into the tunnel could be considered. These restrictive rules about what was and was not permissible in the proceedings required everyone to act like the tunnel plan exists in a vacuum, as if the four-mile stretch of pipeline in the Straits is connected to nothing, as if the oil pipeline transports comes from nowhere and has no destination, as if global warming is a localized phenomenon, as if the pipeline has no past and no history, as if it causes no effects, as if time doesn't exist, as if pipelines have no social consequences. All that's left, after one has adopted such a myopic and morally bankrupt view, are narrow, mystifying, technocratic matters." I'll provide a link to Insko's article on leftoflansing.com, and he's right. The odds were stacked against all those who don't have corporate power and dollars backing them. This decision happened, by the way, just days after Kyle Davidson from Michigan Advance reported how PLG Consulting, which advises a variety of industries, including oil and gas, concluded in a report that a shutdown of the Line 5 pipeline would be both commercially and operationally feasible. But no. These commissioners went along with whatever the corporation says over the people wanted. Oh, and by the way, Kyle's story also added this little important nugget. Additionally, decarbonization and the growth of the electric vehicle industry in the United States and Canada have reduced the demand for gasoline and will continue to reduce the use of fossil fuels, according to that report. So, we're talking about saving our state, our country, and the world by weaning ourselves off fossil fuels. I mean, Governor Whitmer, who just this week announced an executive order saying that all state fleet vehicles must be emission-free by 2040, just watch these commissioners, whom she appointed, fail to take such actions under consideration for the absurdness of this costly tunnel project. This is just yet another example of how common sense and the survival of our cherished resources and the lives that depend on those resources are being shoved aside for corporate greed and for short-term gains. Well, joining me here in just a few to discuss this issue and other issues, including the desperate fight that progressives are experiencing to tip the scales from extreme right-wing viewpoints and policies, which have dominated our state's politics for far too long, and tip them back to a more progressive and more common sense viewpoints and policies, is Democratic State Representative Emily Diefendorf. The representative will be with me here right after these quick words. You are listening to LOL.
It's the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. Need to give Pat a piece of your mind, or do you have some stories you think Pat should cover? Email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com. And if you have Michigan beer ideas for Pat, he'll love you even more. Now, here's Pat.
Hey, coming up next week, Livingston County progressive activist, host of The Stir podcast, and good friend of this podcast, Casey Helton, will be my guest. Actually, she'll be the last guest of 2023 as I'm taking the final 2 weeks off here for the holidays. But don't worry. I'll be right back here after the new year as 2024 will be another pivotal year for Michigan and the rest of the country as we will have an important election to not only keep Michigan progressing forward, but to also ensure that our democratic institutions are strengthened and protected rather than torn apart, which is exactly what this state's right wing wants to do. Actually, the right wing across the entire country wants to do. So again, Casey Helton joins me next week. This week, I'm happy to have Democratic State Representative Emily Diefendorf here on the podcast. They represent the 77th House District, which is around North Lansing, DeWitt, and Watertown Township. Now, Representative Diefendorf is a bold progressive advocate and, along with other legislative progressives, is fighting to shift the Overton window, which has been pushed further and further and further to the right during the last 40 or 50 years here in this country. And they've also been able to do just that with some of the legislative victories that Democrats have enjoyed here this past year. So joining me to talk some about those victories and more is State Representative Emily Diefendorf. Thank you so very much for being on this week.
Thank you for having me. I love that you brought up the Overton window. It's one of my favorite things to educate folks on, and I'm sure your listeners know all about it. So I really appreciate that you recognize that we're trying to get people to understand what is and is not normal and how we don't have to change how we define progressive in order to accommodate extremism.
I've seen you talk about the Overton window previously. I think one of the last few times I saw you talk about it was with Tim Skubick on his show Off the Record a couple of months ago. Maybe you can just explain a little bit about the Overton window and what you think needs to be done to kind of bring it back towards, I would just say, towards the center, because I think it's been over to the right for quite a while.
Yeah. So one of my concerns coming from a background of civil rights and as a result of having worked in civil rights, I have too much experience working on extremism and in opposition to extremism. So I know the phenomenon all too well of becoming acclimated to extreme responses and the co-option of our narratives, our framing, our language, to the point that we may be using the same words, but we're talking about completely different things. We need to always be really aware that we are not changing how we define ourselves and our own philosophies and priorities based on our response to where other people are and who we don't want to be. So the Overton window recognizes that just because some folks might be getting more extreme, it doesn't necessarily make what is reasonable change. It doesn't make somebody who is moderate that much more progressive. It doesn't make somebody who is conservative that much more moderate just because this person over here became that much more extreme and unreasonable. it is still okay to have your bare minimum for humane treatment and civil rights and how we serve our communities be where it has always been. That doesn't change because other people become unreasonable and, frankly, threaten our democracy.
Is it this extremism that you talked about? Is that what made you want to run for office? Because in my reading, you've been involved in public service and advocacy for many years. So I'm assuming that all that experience, plus is it this extremism that you're talking about, did all that play a role into why you decided to run?
Yeah, I started in the legislature in 2001 while I was still at Michigan State and was there and served with two legislators and then left and ran the statewide LGBT civil rights organization before I did my own independent civil rights consulting. So I've done lobbying. I have been a chief of staff for legislators before, but it was in developing an understanding of extremism and also of hate crimes and working to report hate crimes and understanding the underreporting of these types of movements and incidences that I really felt it was important we had folks that had experience in those areas, knew how to recognize incidences of hate and extremism, and were able to document it and start to get in front of it at a certain point. After 2020, it became apparent that government is absolutely a number one target for extremism, government and the breakdown of democracy itself. So we need people who are willing to be realistic and to not downplay the savviness and the far reach and the coordination of our extremist movements and their attempt to really undermine what we've been trying to build. And at the same time, trying to build up more our participation in our own democracy, because that is really what I noticed the constituents in my district wanted as I was knocking on doors. They didn't want necessarily a particular party. They wanted cooperation. They wanted to feel like their say mattered, that their vote mattered, and that they had a say in their own policies and what impacted their lives. And at the moment that I was running, they didn't feel like democracy was a system that they could trust. And that is scary and potentially really dangerous.
Well, since you brought that up, do you feel like you are able to find, how do I put this? I guess maybe some common ground with people on the other side of the aisle? Because to me, just going to lay it out there, I just feel like that one side doesn't really want to work and doesn't want to deal with the realism that you were just talking about. You said that word realism. I don't feel like that's really happening at most of the times. I'm sure there are times that you're able to find some common ground on certain things. But with that extremism, which seems to have just completely engulfed or taken over the other side, are you able to really find any kind of working relationship with them? I mean, again, you brought up realism. I don't feel like that other side right now is dealing with realism.
So I'll be really blunt as well. I committed to getting to know my entire district. And after redistricting, I ended up with the city of Lansing, the city of Grand Ledge, and this huge rural area above those two municipal areas. A lot of farmland and a lot of farmland that was, I would say, after lots of conversations, justifiably worried about the gradual loss of small family farms. So throughout the time I've spent getting to know so much of my rural constituency, I have been very blunt with what really is a Republican stronghold in the rural parts of my district, about how I will not entertain claims of xenophobia, of legitimacy of xenophobia, or efforts to block international trade or anything like that. I will always be open to concerns about whether we are thinking far ahead enough when we're talking about building up our infrastructure. I will always be open to people wanting to be a part of conversations about the planning of their own lives, whether that's the capacity in their schools or whether that is making sure that a family farm doesn't go away if they're not ready to go away. Because once you lose a family farm, it does not come back. There are so many things. If there is no housing or not enough housing in an area, it really is true that folks have reason to believe it might not be feasible for us to drop a plant in a community that does not have housing and does not have infrastructure in place. So we do need to listen to the concerns of our rural communities because they do know what their communities do and don't have. And one of the things that I've found is that when you're willing to be in conversation, there is common ground. People want a say in their own lives, whether it is in the middle of Lansing or whether it is out in Eagle Township. I have Eagle Township. We know what's been happening in Eagle Township. People are not going to sit back and let other people make decisions for them. And I would never ask them to. And I will acknowledge that I've been told by other Democrats, they're not going to vote for you, Emily. And I say, you're right. And also, don't suggest I would only talk to the constituents who would vote for me. I need to understand what all of my district needs. And all of my district is a little bit frustrated with feeling that they are not sure that their representation is their representation. So I need to make sure that folks know that I am listening to their concerns. I'm taking seriously the concerns that are grounded in real experience. And also that I'm not a sucker. I'm not going to take irrational fears and run with it. I am not going to harm other folks based on somebody's hurt. We're going to have a rational conversation about what everybody needs.
So you're not afraid to get out of that bubble. Yeah, everybody always talks about how there's the conservative bubble, liberal bubble, right? Progressive bubbles, whatever, that you are comfortable going out and trying to find some common ground with all of your constituents and that you want them to all feel like that somebody's listening at least.
Absolutely. Everybody wants to be heard. And I will say that for all of the pushback that I've seen in the rural parts of my district, they're not coming for me. After all of this time, they may have frustrations with a lot of the other representation that they don't feel have listened, but they know that if I have a question or if they are frustrated because they do want to talk to me, you know, I will try to set up a time to get out there. I will bring folks out to see the farm. I will bring folks out to have that conversation. And this is something that I say to my colleagues as well, that engaging people always makes a difference. And they can tell the difference between you just talking the talk and listening for the sake of just putting in the time and you listening and taking to heart the concerns and trying to find resolution and middle ground. Our constituents are not stupid.
Well, Representative, if you don't mind, since you brought up the issue of how some rural areas may be against a corporation putting a plant where they are located, especially if there's no infrastructure or if they could be concerned about how it will, let's say, affect the environment or other factors, as long as it's not all about practicing xenophobia, which you just mentioned. What is your position when it comes to the state giving corporations millions of dollars, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars, to build a plant in a certain area? Do you think that is the best way to grow an economy? Is that the best way to gain trust with people? Is that the best way to not just keep people here in Michigan, but to attract people to want to come to Michigan? What's your whole position when it comes to that issue?
This is a regular conversation that I've been having lately, and I attribute that to the activity in Eagle Township, and I don't say that in a bad way. For me, it is not debatable. We need to move towards a clean energy future, and that does mean investing in chips. It does mean investing in battery plants. It means moving us towards EVs, but we don't do that by sacrificing the communities that we are bringing these industries to. After the conversations that I've engaged in for the last year, I really believe that the only ethical way to continue to build up that structure within Michigan so that we can compete, so that we can lead in the EV industry, is to engage our rural communities from the beginning, talk to them about what they need and want, And some of the things I already mentioned, infrastructure, but also the use of resources, because these are farming communities. They also need the water supply. They need to know what disposal of the manufacturing waste is going to look like and that it's going to be safe. They need to know what the environmental and health standards are going to be and how they're going to be monitored. They need to know that their schools have capacity. They need to know that the housing has capacity. But beyond all of that, they need to feel like we aren't just pitching them something that because we feel it's good for the future and the rest of Michigan, and that we're not thinking about what the incentive is to their own community right now and in the future. I feel like we, as much as we think about the incentives for the corporations themselves, because we are pouring a lot of money into that, we also need to think about what do these communities already like about themselves? What are they afraid of losing? Because in Eagle Township, they don't even get revenue sharing. We're talking about communities so small that their parks aren't kept up by our tax dollars. They don't have well-developed municipal resources. But we would like to put something huge there without their input. So we could do a better job of finding out what these communities need and want and what has been neglected in these communities that they would like built, and then invest in that community in what it likes about itself. At the same time, we are investing in the corporation and making sure the corporations want to come and succeed there. Because otherwise, what reason does the community have to accept this? It's not going to consider these investments the gift that we want it to be if they don't feel like it is a gift for them.
Is that something then you want to push in the future when it comes to giving more incentives to a corporation that wants to set up shop somewhere? Do you want to ensure, maybe, I don't know if safeguards is the right word, but do you just want to ensure there's some type of criteria to ensure that the local communities are being heard and that their concerns are being met?
I absolutely want to ensure that we invest in local communities at the same time. I've also done a couple of other things to balance this out, because one of the concerns that our local rural communities bring up to me as well, look at the mistakes made in the past. Has the auto industry successfully cleaned up some of our racer trust sites, our Superfund sites? And no, in Lansing, we have giant wastelands covered in concrete that we have remediated to the point of stability when it comes to PFAS, but they are not at the point where they can be used for commercial or residential purposes. So they're just giant wastelands. And so I do feel it is important that we start to set an example of, if we are going to push for manufacturing projects, we set the expectation that there is an understanding at jump, at the start of the project, that you have a plan for how you will be cleaning up the project and the products you're creating and everything that is entailed in creating those products at the start of the project, that you have an end of project life plan for how you're going to break everything down. Because these communities have a valid argument when they say, but look at that mess that was created. And the example that I always give is when our kids are playing with toys, we say, you don't get to move on to the next thing until you pick up your toys. We don't do the same thing with manufacturing. So I did work to try to negotiate the cleanup of one of Lansing's biggest racer trust sites as we were talking about our motor plants, getting more of our tax incentives, because I said, you know, we should acknowledge that there is argument to be made here that, yes, we don't have land to use in the city because we have not cleaned it up. And our policy thus far is to not remediate it to the point of complete stability until there's a buyer. And what sense does that make that we keep moving out and out and out because we aren't cleaning up our messes? In addition to that, I also have introduced a bill that closes a loophole that's existed for hundreds of years. And the loophole exists for low-income property owners that don't have a will. And it's the Partition of Heirs Property Act. It's one of the main ways that Black and Brown farmers have lost farms throughout the history of this country. Because in absence of a will, you aren't able to hand down your property. It is easily split up. So this piece of legislation has been easily passed in the South because it was prioritized with no opposition. It's something that estate lawyers are really interested in seeing happen because it's a giant headache, but also it really helps small family farmers and really low-income property owners, period, hold on to the equity that they have in absence of a will. Because so often the most vulnerable folks just do not have that legal assistance in place.
I did not know that. And so that sounds like to me, though, common sense, what you're proposing there. Would you think that you would get some kind of support from even Republicans?
For the Partition of Heirs Property Act, there is absolutely no opposition. And in fact, I'm getting suggestions or offers of support from folks all over the country right now who are just really excited to see something happening with it in Michigan. And even the Farm Bureau is absolutely neutral on it. So they just are fine with wanting to see the loophole closed. As I'm going across the country I'm doing a lot of work and trying to learn about agricultural and modern agricultural purposes or practices. And it's one of the main policies that is always brought up in just about every session. I'm excited to see that the coalitions so far that exist to support it are truly very broad, whether it is an attorney that just wants to make it so that their job is that much easier, or whether it's civil rights groups that want to make sure that the most vulnerable among us are able to hold on to the equity that they have.
That's great. Democratic State Representative Emily Diefendorf is my guest here. All right. If you don't mind, I'd just like to switch over here to the clean energy and jobs bills that Democrats passed and Governor Whitmer signed into law last week. And I've covered these bills here as they've been making their way through Lansing throughout the summer. Talked to numerous guests about it, but I'll just bring it up here real quick. Some of these bills do some good things, like making Michigan a clean energy state. More energy efficient benchmarks and incentives are part of these bills. And there's also extra help for those in low-income areas on that front. But there's also some disappointing parts, like including natural gas being considered clean energy. And I get some of the criticisms of these bills, but I also get the arguments that it's at least an important first step for Michigan's environmental and economic future. And I know that you voted for the bill package. So can I get your overall viewpoint on it? And what do you think needs to be tackled next by Democrats on this front to help ensure that, let's say, environmental justice takes a bigger priority the next time?
Yeah, I was very much in favor of this package. And I also would like to see the changes a lot of our legislators would like to see happen, including more of an emphasis on environmental justice. I did encourage more local participation in the siting process when the bills moved from the Senate to the House for a lot of the reasons that we already discussed, based on the response of local communities to the economic development that we've already done. But there really is no option for us in Michigan or anywhere but to move forward on clean energy. I am a huge science nerd, and the USDA just recently released their climate zones map, and our growing zones are consistently shifting and pretty dramatically. And nobody knows this better than our farmers and our gardeners, because we can grow things that we've never been able to grow before, and we can't grow things that we've always grown. Mm-hmm. This is significant. This affects our entire ecosystem. And we know this based on what blooms early or doesn't bloom. We know this based on what insects are surviving and what animals aren't. This is just based on the degree changes that are going up and down a few degrees here and there. Based on climate change, I mean, really, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about global warming. So we cannot afford to not move forward towards a clean energy standard. And we have to take into consideration that some folks needed a compromise in order to transition. And at the same time, we still needed a deadline. We still need to be ambitious about it, because when it comes to climate change, there isn't any going backwards. There's only stopping the damage.
Just to kind of piggyback on all this, in my opening segment here today or this week, I shared my outrage, and I know there are many others out there, over the disappointment of the Michigan Public Service Commission's green lighting of Enbridge to build a tunnel around the old Line 5 pipeline under the Straits of Mackinac. And I think what angers so many about this is how it feels like no matter what people say, no matter how many people are against the pipeline. Corporations' needs always seem to take a greater precedence over the people and over the environment. Let's just be honest. And you tweeted right after the decision, if you don't mind. I'm just going to read the one line. You said, "This is not how we get to a clean energy future that doesn't endanger the community." I was wondering, Representative, if you could just expound on that statement a bit.
Yeah, I was really astounded and also not astounded. I do think that we need to do an evaluation of who has been appointed to the Michigan Public Service Commission and how and what interests they represent. I will say that directly. I will say that acknowledging that I am a Dan Scripps fan.
And just let me say here real quick, Dan Scripps is the MPSC chairman. Anyway, go ahead.
But it is a concern of many folks that there's too much industry representation. But that decision should not have come out of that commission. Not when, with the incredible responsibility that it has, and now the additional responsibility we just gave them with clean energy siting for solar, our future is in their hands. What really concerned me in addition to that is I think about line five in terms of people's lives. To me, this is not just about, and I don't mean just when I say jobs, but I'm going to be really frank here. I'm still in touch with some folks who are family through former marriage who live in the Sioux, on the reservation in the Sioux. And obviously, we know that many of our Indigenous communities in Michigan have already taken a position on this. They're supposed to be able to have a say in this whole process. Their position has been ignored, and they have been the stewards of these resources for so long, but rightfully, because their lives depend on it, their livelihoods, their daily practices, and they're honestly, there are no better stewards of our land and our resources than our Indigenous communities. So to me, when I saw that decision, I just immediately thought about the catastrophic possibilities. And I realized it was somewhat of a selfish emotional response. I'm thinking about people I know. I'm thinking about people I care about. But I'm also thinking in a more abstract way about all of the Michiganders that live up and around there and the huge percentage of people throughout the country that depend on the Michigan Great Lakes. To me, this is not about the inconvenience of, or it shouldn't be about the inconvenience of transitioning over. We have to figure it out, or we should have just taken on the challenge of figuring it out, rather than to put ourselves in an extended position of continuing that danger to one of our greatest assets and resources, but also the lifeblood of whole communities and also so much of the country. But to me, very real people. And that's a lot.
All right. I know that we're out of time, but I was wondering if I could just ask you one more question. When you were in high school or college, did you feel like you were a part of the democratic process at all? Because when I was in high school and even parts of, even in college, I really didn't feel like anybody really wanted to hear what I had to say. And I was wondering, when you answer that question, is that why you helped push for a bill that Governor Whitmer just signed into law, which automatically registers voters once they are issued a state ID? I think this would mean that 16-year-olds would be pre-registered. I remember talking with one of your colleagues, Democratic State Representative Betsy Cafia, about this last summer, and she said that one of the goals of the bill would be to make younger people feel part of the democratic process. And since we were talking about the importance of democracy earlier here when we kicked off this interview, is that why you pushed for it?
So I'm never going to be a good example of a typical youth. As a teenager, I was already an activist and advocate. I was editor of my school paper. I was writing editorials for the local paper, the Kalamazoo Gazette, because I came to Lansing to go to Michigan State. But I was writing editorials about marriage equality before anybody was talking about marriage equality. And parents would write the school asking me to get kicked off the school paper. And Bill Clinton was running for president, and I wrote the White House asking for a press pass, and they gave it to me. Honestly, security could have been a little tighter. But so I was very, very engaged. And also, I mean, people know I have very high expectations for myself and for others. But I was already very politically engaged. I was very socially conscious. And I was so excited to vote. I voted as soon as I possibly could. I think the only time I have ever missed a vote was, I've worked every single election that I could, was due to working an election and not being able to get to the polls. And I can't even tell you when that was. I've worked every small or big election. I've done election protection. I've served just about every role that you can. So it's important to me that we do more election protection and make voting accessible, because voting is the most essential, bare minimum entry action we can do to be a part of democracy. And after that is accountability for our electeds. We should be in continuous communication with our electeds. And I was telling somebody that works for Gary Peters the other day, one of our Republican trackers reached out to me the other day. And I told you I talk to everybody, and I'm always very kind, but also I know who my constituents are. And I get to know everybody, and I've gotten to know this person, and he needed help with his voter registration. And what's important to me is that people vote. And I said, yes, let me help you. And we figured it out. And it was just like the loveliest conversation. I won't fill you in on all of it, but to me, it was just like, you know, I really appreciate that people are put in the effort to try to vote. It should not be so hard. And I hope that it is always recognized that what is important to me is that we are participating in the process.
Absolutely. Great way to end this. Democratic State Representative Emily Diefendorf, thank you so very much for being on this week. There's much more I wanted to talk about. We didn't even get to your housing bill of rights or the renter's bill of rights. And I was wondering, maybe sometime after the new year, you could come back on for about 20 minutes and we could actually cover some of that as well.
Absolutely. I would love to talk about it.
All right. Well, thank you so very much, Representative Diefendorf, for being on, and have a happy new year.
Thank you. You too.
It's progressivism with passion. It's the Left of Lansing podcast, where Pat shines a light on Michigan's progressive movement. Contact Pat at leftoflansing@gmail.com.
Time now for a Left of Lansing last call. You know, I didn't have time to bring this up during my discussion with Representative Diefendorf, but I want to remind everyone here that the representative won her primary election by some 25 votes. 25 votes. So don't ever say your vote doesn't matter. Representative Diefendorf defeated former college basketball standout John Horford, who also played at the University of Michigan before going pro for a couple of years. Now, he was the Democratic Party establishment's candidate, and he got most of the big party name endorsements as well. And yet, the more progressive candidate found a way to win, and Diefendorf then rolled to a general election victory. And they did it, just like the other progressives that we've talked to here on this podcast through the years, by talking to every voter as possible and by showing how they'll be a fighter for the common good. As you heard the representative say, if you just show voters that you are listening to their concerns and showing how there is some common ground with many voters, especially maybe economically speaking, you might get their support. And I'd even posit that progressives like Diefendorf are making a difference already and making some big-time changes despite facing some systematic roadblocks in Lansing, which I've talked about with others here as well. Kyle Malin from the City Pulse noted recently how this Democratic legislature has voted more progressive than ever. Malin writes, and I quote, "For the last 19 years, the bell curve has looked more consistent. The average liberal voting record for every Democratic House member for the last 19 years has been 75.95%. This year, however, the average House Democrat voted the liberal position 94.5% of the time on the 49 bills that we tracked, nearly every time," unquote. Now, why did that happen? Because progressive policies like expanding free meals for public school students, eliminating right to work for less, expanding the child tax credit, expanding LGBTQ+ protections, expanding abortion rights, passing gun safety measures, taking guns out of the hands of domestic abusers, ending the pension tax, and passing some of the first meaningful clean energy bills in this state's history. You have to remember, all of those policies are popular with the people. It's been there for the taking, and progressives in the legislature and outside the legislature just might be moving that Overton window after all.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan, it's Pat Johnston.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of The Left of Lansing. I'd like to thank Democratic State Representative Emily Diefendorf for being on this week and for giving their keen insights on so many issues. It was a pleasure to have the representative on, and I look forward to having them on again next year. And again, my final episode of 2023 is next week, and I can't think of a better way to close things out than to have a Livingston County progressive activist, Casey Elton, joining me for a fantastic and informative discussion. And before I go, I'd just like to say rest in peace to longtime TV producing icon Norman Lear, who died this week at the age of 101. Lear is responsible for bringing some of the most groundbreaking and hilarious shows in the history of not just television, but in the history of media. And he found ways to discuss controversial topics while being funny. Lear's shows left a mark with me, as All in the Family, The Jeffersons, and Good Times are all programs which found ways to thread serious everyday topics of the times, like war and women's rights, race, abortion rights, economic rights, and more. And yet, through it all, he could make us laugh. You know, it was like those shows were a mirror of what America was really like. And that's why so many millions of people could relate to those shows. So rest in peace, Norman Lear. Until next time, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan.
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston. Written by Pat Johnston. Researched by Pat Johnston. Edited by Pat Johnston. And hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.